Good morning, I'm Paul, host of the New P&L podcast and founder of the New P&L Brand Purpose Institute, where we work with business leaders, employees and entrepreneurs just like you and empower them to build brands with purpose on purpose. We deliver this through an extensive range of workshops, consultancies, strategic counsel and keynote presentations. So if you'd like to discuss how to build your brand with purpose on purpose, then please don't hesitate to get in touch. We believe business needs a new P&L, one that is as much focused on principles and leadership as it is on profit and loss. Because we know if your principles are right and aligned with your purpose and your leadership has a clear vision and focus and strength and empathy, then your business will be in profit and not loss in so many ways. This week on the new P&L Deep Discussion interview, we speak to Lisa Thee. Lisa is a top 50 global thought leader for AI, privacy and safety, with experience in delivering and solving complex business technology, governance, privacy, and risk challenges at scale. Lisa consults to some of the world's most innovative healthcare and global technology companies. And she is also CEO and co-founder of MineGuard, an artificial intelligence software company that is focused on making children safer online and in real life. Lisa is also a keynote speaker with a range of awards and accolades, including being nominated as a top thought leader and influencer for health and safety, privacy and AI in 2021, selected as a woman in business you should follow by Thinkers 360, and also named as one of the top 100 brilliant women in AI ethics in 2022. So Lisa, a very warm welcome to the new P&L. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here, Paul. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
My pleasure. Perhaps we can start the conversation with you giving listeners just a bit of information and an overview about what you do and who you do it for.
Sure. So as an entrepreneur, I entered the world of AI about 6 years ago, deploying solutions in the wild, first under a large company umbrella and a multinational tech firm as an AI solution owner at Intel Corporation, and then ultimately leading my own software company with a friend of mine from Apple that we co-founded to make kids safer online and in real life. Once I exited that company into a larger player in the safety space market, I went into management consulting. So I work with some of the world's leading healthcare and technology companies to help them focus on bringing influential people and innovation together to address challenging problems at scale, including things like getting AI approved for FDA medical purposes for use in clinical settings with enough diverse data to make sure that it doesn't have intrinsic bias that doesn't benefit marginalized groups, all the way to working in digital safety for online tech platforms and dealing with some of the challenges of hate speech moving from online into real life.
So technology clearly binds all of those things together, but so does a moral imperative on your behalf. And I wanted to start by understanding, what are the core values that underpin and drive your work across these various areas? You know, what are the common values that bring these initiatives together and why?
Yeah, I would say the values that always stick out to me most strongly are things like integrity. I think a lot of challenges that we see in moral imperatives and technology are not a technology problem. They're a will-to-act problem. Yeah. I think sometimes instead of optimizing for a single bottom line, looking at a double bottom line approach to solutions, especially for problems at scale that have been challenges for humanity since the beginning of time, are really critical in order to make sure we're balancing improving our legacy as well as our profit and loss statements. I think sometimes groups are left behind in those discussions and conversations because frankly, they don't have the representation in the rooms where decisions are made. So with that, I feel a strong responsibility to represent marginalized women and children globally in some of those rooms as those conversations are happening, because I think a lot of times it's an error of omission, not of malice.
Yes.
And so making sure that we have more representation in artificial intelligence, in data science, and product management, and in the C-suite and boardrooms where, you know, they're really thinking through ESG impacts of decisions that companies are making is really critical to start to shore up some of the challenges that we've seen from unintended consequences of platforms at scale.
So part of the challenge, I guess, is that AI development isn't it's not a single linear process. It's humans with their own cultural and society and life experiences making assumptions when developing software. and using that data that is also subject to similar or different biases, and then providing that software to other businesses to input it and based on their own subjective assumptions and so on and so on and so on. So who should be responsible for defining what bias is or what objectivity is in AI? And then who should be responsible for policing the standard that is then set?
Well, I first want to comment on your original part of the question, which is absolutely accurate. AI is a tool. It is not a solution. So it's really good at finding pearls of wisdom and oceans of information. Yep. It's really the humans that are particularly uniquely qualified to define what problems you're solving with that tool, and also what is imperative to optimize around as you're making trade-offs and decisions. The machines are really, really good at things that machines do well: math, repetitive tasks, tactical, you know, execution type of things. And so I think that there are a lot of minds that are congregating right now to think about who should be policing this. I don't think I have the magical answer. The only information that I can share is typically in the areas of safety by design and privacy, Europe tends to lead in terms of legislation. So I won't be surprised if that's what happens in this instance as well. But this is really a multinational problem. This is not a country by country challenge. It's something we really need to look at with a holistic lens, and really understand how do we make the right trade-offs so that we're optimizing for the most good for everyone, not just small groups of people that will disproportionately benefit.
As you say, it's clearly a multinational challenge. Is there, because of all of a multiplicity of vested interests, can there ever be a multi-country, a multinational solution to this?
I think that it will be industry and government coming together in the public and private sector by topic area that will probably make the most impact here. And the reason for that is, just like cybersecurity, the threat vectors are going to continue to evolve over time. Yeah. And so it's not going to be a one and done solution and walk away and we all celebrate and move on. It's going to be something that has to be an active conversation as technology evolves, as social issues evolve, and as legislation evolves. Yeah. I think there's some great roadmaps for how to do this well in terms of some industry collaborations that are global in nature in partnership with government. One of those examples is in the child sexual abuse material space. I think every platform agrees that they don't want illegal, felonious content of the worst day of a child's life on their platforms. And so they come together in industry consortiums to share best practices, because once it's on one platform, it quickly spreads to others. So everybody can agree that that's a vested interest, that we just get it down as fast as possible. So I think there's some really good examples with industry groups like the Tech Coalition, We Protect Global Alliance, Thorn, different convening bodies that are kind of setting that framework. And I think we also saw that with some leading legislation from Australia when the aberrant violent terrorism legislation came out a couple of years back around making sure that after the Christchurch shooting, we all have some accountability in getting those types of live stream terrorism event videos taken down as fast as humanly possible. And that launched the GIFCT that works together, that mirrors a lot of the Tech Coalition work in that space. And it also created a even playing field for the tech industry to come together to have a collaboration so that, you know, once it's on Facebook, it's not 2 seconds before it's on Twitter and Snapchat and TikTok and everywhere else. So how do we come together to really put the right focus and sense of urgency on the right material? And I think that's going to continue to be an evolving space for each topic area that we decide legislatively needs to be addressed. And I think hate speech is starting to be the next wave of where we're going to see that legislation come in, especially with the Facebook whistleblower.
Mm-hmm. The government legislation and all the legislative process, the regulatory process, is notoriously slow for a multitude of reasons. The example that you've just given perhaps demonstrated an occasion where necessity drove a much more agile and flexible and urgent approach to the change in legislation. Do you see that, the success of that, do you see that replicating in the future? Do you think there's a model there for government to work more collaborating closely and urgently with the private sector in that regard, with these other examples?
just like any innovation, I see some people doing it better than others, some governments doing it better than others. I think there's a will out there of some people that have cross-pollinated between the public and private mm-hmm. sector that are leading in the digital safety space. An example of that to me is your eSafety commissioner with Julie Ingram Grant. She's somebody I really respect and admire and look up to in that space. And I think we're going to need a lot more of that, of people that have been tech insiders being available to government legislators to make sure that there isn't confusion about what is possible and not possible. Mm-hmm. And there isn't a convergence of being unclear about what's in the business interest versus what's feasible. I think that we didn't have seatbelts in automobiles for the first 20 years that they mm-hmm. were popular, but eventually we get to a place where there's enough cars on the road that the number of accidents and the number of deaths exceeds an acceptable standard. And so we put in some safety regulations. I think we're seeing some momentum building in that space. It's not coming as fast as I would like to see it. I think we all saw the lack of it being exacerbated through the pandemic when people were isolated. And so they had a lot more time online, especially young people. I think we're starting to see the output of that. And I think there's just a lower tolerance for the blasé attitude of free speech, whatever. We're gambling with a whole generation of people. It's not an acceptable cost anymore. And especially when you look into, you know, global perspectives of places that don't have enough content moderation, I think we are all much more attuned to what can happen with mis and disinformation at scale when it's not happening in English and you don't have an army of people that can jump in and intervene. It can have catastrophic consequences and it can happen fast.
Yes. I guess part of the problem or the challenge is that there's also a lack of understanding of the problems and the possibilities of these platforms and AI and so on. So legislators are expected to pass legislation or regulation on things that aren't entirely understood. The CBART example you gave is a great one of a more obvious practical application. You can see it. You see there's a problem. You address that problem. And that took 20 years. Many of the challenges we face now, we can't see, we don't quite understand, whether we're in the public or private sector. How do we get over the education and understanding before the legislating?
That's a great question. The legislation process is honestly pretty new to me as well. I've been in the technology industry for 20 years. So that doesn't make me qualified to be a government politician advocate. So I'm navigating through those waters as a citizen myself. I did a TED talk last summer that I created a petition to try to help improve some of these circumstances. And so I'm working with my local congressional legal aid representative to introduce some laws in California to help support better digital safety standards per the Department of Justice Task Force recommendations for human trafficking prevention. Mm-hmm. But I feel like a babe in the woods myself. I literally am like emailing my local district person, starting a conversation. I think it's just going to be a willingness to be a little bit more vulnerable. And make sure that your voice is heard. You don't have to have all the answers to make sure that the people that are making the decisions understand it's incredibly important to you. And until there are consequences for neglect of investment in this innovation area, similar to what we saw with cybersecurity 10 years ago, we're not going to see companies being held accountable to figuring out the solution. I think we have to shape the problem better and they can respond. I'd rather see the technology folks come with their best ideas to solve this at scale than be prescriptive in how they do it. But I think we have to be really, really clear from the society side what success looks like so that our legislators can make sure that we're asking for the right things.
Yeah, I agreed. You're the co-author of Demystifying Artificial Intelligence for the Enterprise. And one of your key focuses, as I understand it, for 2022 is around demystifying that AI experience in the enterprise. Can you talk me through what that means in practice? What are some of the most common myths and how do you demystify them?
Yeah, I co-author the chapters on the customer journey for and also corporate social responsibility. So giving your audience, I'm going to choose to focus more on the second one.
Sure. Yep.
And so what I think there is, you know, it's really important that we help to train executives to embrace artificial intelligence for digital transformation. You need to have the right mix of subject matter experts with the humans, with the machines to augment them, to make sure they have the right information at the right time to be spending their time and accelerate in the places that you want to see change. One of the places that is really prevalent in making sure that you have a really positive ROI for companies for corporate social responsibility, for example, can be supply chain. Making sure that you don't have labor trafficking in your supply chain. We've all seen instances where brands have lost a significant amount of value in the stock market because stories break about labor trafficking violations. And a lot of times that is because they don't know how to find the signal and the noise of their own data, of their supply chain. Yes. And so I think tools like AI can help to bring the right information to the people that are responsible for that at the right time, so that they can do what they do uniquely well, which is take action, but they're not drowning in so much information that you can't make any sense out of it. There's no wisdom to glean when it's just numbers and data everywhere.
In recent years, we've seen, an incredible convergence of many sectors and technology innovation. You think about bioscience and health, and all of those sectors are a great example of big tech entering the space. If we think about Google or Amazon or Apple, for example, being the most obvious. And that convergence has the potential to change the shape of many of those industries in many ways, including, I think importantly, the way they're funded and who funds them, the thinking and the motivation that sits behind the R&D and where the focus of that innovation should be, because it becomes more focused on certain commercial aspects. And I guess also the transparency of that industry. What's your view on the challenges and the opportunities of this convergence of these big tech and AI businesses moving into bioscience, healthcare, and so on in a more en masse way, if you like?
Yeah, one of the predictions I just saw for 2022 is from a thought leader, favorite thought leader of mine from Spectrum Labs and the Trust and Safety industry group, Tiffany Wang. And her prediction for 2022 is there's going to be the rise of the chief trust officer. Mm-hmm. And I think there's going to be space for that. I think that ethics is something that we've been talking about for a few years, but I felt a little early to the party back, you know, 6-7 years ago. It was like a nice to have, but not a need to have in terms of functional roles. And I think that that is going to be some of the changes that we see with this hyper-convergence between what was typically handled by the public sector coming into the private sector is a requirement from society and government that ethics be forefront, that there is a lot more transparency in how we're measuring these things. There's a lot more research done on the impacts of choices that we make. I'm looking forward to a day when there just is a little bit more balance in the development process, that it's not just, a group of 20 people behind a closed conference room door deciding, how a whole industry is going to get disrupted. That there are thoughtful people from different points of view that are contributing, because just because we can go fast and break things in tech, I don't want to see my healthcare get broken. I want to see that handled thoughtfully, but I also want to see that it evolves faster than it does today.
Yes.
One of the clients that I work with that has been one of the more fun projects I've had the opportunity to contribute to has been a research hospital that has been developing IP to help get more medical research data available to AI developers in the healthcare space to accelerate FDA approvals for clinical use of models. I look forward to the day when there's more novel models available on the market for specific issues that doctors have available to make sure that, they make the right decisions at the right times. In order for that to happen, you need some innovation acceleration. Yes. If it goes at the pace of a research hospital, it'll be a great solution in 2050.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to wait that long. So I think there is a lot of opportunity with those industries coming together, but we have to learn from each other and make sure that we have the right regulation in place to do it responsibly.
There's a great article I read from Alan Rushberger a few months back, the ex-editor of The Guardian here in the UK, and he talked about, it was interesting the point you raised about a chief trust officer. He suggested that moving forward, every business needs a moral philosopher, if you like, someone who understands the basic moral tenets of business and of society more generally. And I wondered what your views on the role of a chief trust officer, what would they do on a daily basis? What are the mechanics of the role?
Yeah. You know, I'm just spitballing here, but yeah. I just got off last week from attending the Women in AI Ethics Conference. And so some of the thoughts that I saw resonating there are really understanding the implications to marginalized groups, that mm-hmm. just because something doesn't affect you negatively doesn't mean it doesn't affect a large swath of the population negatively. I think an example that was as well understood is the concept of surveillance technology. Yes. I don't think anybody, when we were developing tech to recover missing children that were actively being human trafficked, wanted to that technology to be reapplied to, you know, human rights abuses in foreign countries where people are being yes. carted away. That was never the intention there, right? So I think it's going to be kind of a mix of my passions. When I got to school in college 100 years ago now, I called my mom and I said, I want to be a social worker when I grow up. And she said, that's awesome. I pay for engineering school, but feel free to study whatever you'd like. And I wasn't sure that I wanted that much debt coming out yes. of school as a young person. So I went with the flow. But having that more social worker mindset of how do we serve our communities best at scale in combination with technology, I think is a really powerful lens to look at things with. And I think that there's a lot more consultancies that are popping up in this space, nonprofits in this space that are doing really great think tanks in this area. I like to contribute to All Tech as Human. I'm a super fan of the Center for Humane Technology. I am an expert contributor to them when I can be. I think they all made us a lot smarter about the challenges that we face online for the next 20 years with the Social Dilemma movie that they made available globally. So I think there's going to be an intersection of the humanities and technology coming to bear in those types of roles. And I think that, you know, it's a natural outcome of AI. When yes. we have supercomputers that can do the repetitive traditional things that we've historically relied on humans to do and honestly rewarded them very handsomely for in the mathematics and STEM fields, which is where my roots are from, a lot of people are going to find out that computers can do that.
Yeah.
And we need to focus on what we do uniquely well as humans, which is intuition, judgment, being able to think through the policy side of this and make sure that our technology reflects our values, not what we accidentally are able to get out the door.
Do you think some of that, the issue behind that is because we have, and it's understandable why it has occurred, but because we have perceived as a society and as business owners and leaders and managers that technology solves rather than technology serves, you know, and if we took more nuanced understanding that technology is there to serve us, helping to solve the problem rather than it solves it in itself. It has no agency, does it? That's the reality of it. It's there to serve, not to solve.
I mean, most AI is really just looking at pattern recognition and saying, yes. this is what happened 100 million times over of people like you. So this is probably what'll happen if you do this. I think the way that you stated it is optimal. I can't think of a better way to state it than, you know, it's there to serve, not solve.
Many tech businesses are almost natural monopolies in some regards. What responsibilities do you think they have as entrepreneurial leaders to business and society and government in return for that position? Do you think they're almost natural monopolies, I guess, is the first question. And if you do, what are their responsibilities in return for that position?
I think that whoever owns the labeled data will be king. And mm-hmm. since there were companies that naturally have been collecting that data longer than others and have had users that were kind enough to freely label that data for them, there are some very strategic competitive advantages available in the market for large players. And we can probably name them on two hands mm-hmm. In the market there. I would love to say that I knew how to how to solve this kind of challenge. I'm probably not qualified to be the one to make that choice, but I think it's incredibly important that we do think through the consequences of that and put in some checks and balances, because the same way that we make sure that we don't get too much power in one part of government is kind of the same problem for technology's sake. And they really shouldn't be policing themselves. I think the days of the Communication Decency Act 230 and the legislation that was written in the 90s just could not have ever envisioned
yes.
the world that we live in today. And it needs a refresh and a facelift to be modernized. I think we made some progress with the FOSS assessor legislation in 2018, which was the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act in the United States. That allows people that are negatively impacted by platforms that are profiting off of the crimes that mm-hmm. they're being subjected to have some recourse, was a first step. I know it can be controversial for some folks that feel negatively affected by that legislation. However, I just don't think we can go back to the days where we just pretend like nobody's affected by what happens online. And if it's a blatant crime in the real world, we probably should have some controls about managing it as a blatant crime in the online world.
You touched on data in the previous answer, and the person who controls the data is the queen or the king. I wonder whether...
Or it's the kryptonite. Depends what happens.
That's very true. It's very true. How do we, as consumers and as individuals, how do we ensure that we remain more than the sum of ourselves, you know, the more than the sum of our data cells in a world driven by algorithms? How do we maintain our independence as individuals and are not just seen as a data cell for consumption?
I would love to hear your thoughts on that, Paul. I'm not sure I know.
I don't know. That's why I'm asking the question. I think it's an enormous challenge. I think it's one of the biggest challenges we have today.
Yeah, some of it, I go back to just my reading I like to do for personal development. I'm a really big fan of Dr. Brené Brown
yes.
and some of her work in shame and vulnerability. And, you know, in her book, Braving the Wilderness, I love her conversations around it's really hard to hate up close. Mm-hmm. And so at least for me, I personally challenge myself to spend face-to-face time with people that have very different beliefs than I do, politically, religiously, tech regulation wise, cybersecurity, yeah. all those things, because I think the answer is going to lie in the middle ground. It's never going to lie in the extremities. And today, because the culture is generated by clicks and attention and extraction in our economy, I don't think the right conversations are going to happen in technology settings. I think it has to be our humanity that we return to. And so I do a lot of collaborations with cybersecurity experts, because digital safety is the opposite side of the same coin of privacy. You're always going to affect one when you make a trade-off in the other. Just like what I said before, I still passionately believe it's always going to be an evolving landscape based on the threat vectors. And so we're never going to have one answer and be like, okay, we're done, retire. I think the other thing that I really try to focus on a lot is being a visible role model for the next generations to come up.
Yes.
I've been the CEO and operator of a startup. It's exhausting. I'm ready to hand the baton to the young people that are ready to go through that journey of founding something and leading and exiting into, you know, more scalable solutions in the market.
Yeah.
I want to make sure they don't all look exactly the same way and are from the same place and have the same mindset and have the same life experiences as they think through the problems that they're addressing with technology. I think disruption is ripe in a lot of industries. And I also think that talent is equally distributed and we have to be a little bit more motivated to not only give lip service to supporting more diverse founders, but also to funding them. Making yes. sure they have enough capital to get their solutions to market. So I put a lot of time into that. I collaborate with Women in Data globally to make sure that there's more education around entrepreneurship
yeah.
for women in data science. And I really try to focus on doing my keynotes in areas where I can reach broader audiences. Because I think, you know, if you just remember one thing from this conversation, it's that AI is a tool, not a solution. And if you have a really compelling problem that can be both profitable and benefit society, I want to give people a lived role model of what social justice companies can look like at scale, being successful. Because if philanthropy was going to solve this stuff, it would have happened already.
Yeah,
we're going to need that sector to step up. And I don't think the big companies are going to be able to do it with the pressures that they have from the stock market and being publicly traded. I think it's going to have to come from entrepreneurship.
So you've received a number of accolades and awards in recent years for the work you're doing in AI, top 100 brilliant women in AI ethics, 50 AI thought leaders, and so on. So I wanted to just explore a bit more, given your previous answer, in terms of you are very keen to encourage the next generation of female tech entrepreneurs. How do you frame your own story, your own entry into the tech world, your own development through the tech world to the recipient of those accolades? How do you frame your story to inspire that next generation?
Probably depends on any given day to the audience that I'm speaking to. The beauty of it is I'm telling a story of what happened, not what's happening. So yes. I can tune it to to make it sound good for that audience. The reality is it wasn't as graceful as it sounds on podcast interviews and in articles that I write. My husband can attest. There was a lot of days he was there for boundaries and emotional support.
Yes.
You know, breaking through new industries is not always fun. You have to break some eggs to make an omelet, and the result looks great, but it's not necessarily fun to go through. I think that we are really at a place where this next generation is not going to tolerate some of the nonsense that was very mainstay 10, 20 years ago in the workplace. And so that's what gives me hope. I really think that it's not just women or men or diverse or, you know, minority or majority. It's everybody is lifting up and having a little bit more consciousness about how we get things done. And, you know, the generation of people that were raised on these platforms don't have the illusion that it's harmless, that maybe some of the folks that are sitting in positions of power do today.
Yeah.
And so I think I have 100% faith that it's the next generation that's going to make a huge dent in this and continue to improve not just the bottom line, but the top line. And I'm really hopeful for the future. I'm consistently surprised when I show up on these lists. I'm just as shocked as everybody else. I mean, if you would have asked me 6 years ago, I didn't know how to spell AI, which is kind of ironic because it's only two letters. But I think that when you can identify a business problem or a mission that you're incredibly focused on and become the best in class in that, AI can be a tool to get the impact of what you're trying to accomplish at scale.
And no one does it alone. And you've mentioned the support of your husband as well, but in a professional sense, what role has mentorship played in helping you to get where you are now?
Oh, I lean so heavily on folks in a lot of different capacities. So when I was running MinorGuard, a lot of it was my board of directors that I carefully curated to have expertise in spots that were blind spots to me. Mm-hmm. I did not source for people that thought exactly the same way I did in my co-founder of the company and the people that I hired to execute the work. I consistently strive to be the least smart person in every room I walk into, but to know everybody who's incredibly talented in the areas that are required to come together. I think AI tends to be a combination of, you know, my background from school was industrial and operations management engineering to computer science or computer engineering and psychology and how the brain works. And it's a convergence of those three things. And I think it's important to remember that almost no one is great at all of those things simultaneously. They're very different skill sets.
Yeah.
So I aspire to bring and convene groups of people that are much more than the sum of their parts. Whether that be, you know, leading experts in AI on the technical side, whether that be policy people that are thinking through the implications of what does that mean in a multinational environment when you're trying to set these standards, to the folks that are on the front lines of operations that have to use these tools in a practical way. When you can only look at 5% of the content on any given day, how do we make sure that the people that are on the front lines of this are seeing the right content on the right days? To mitigate risk, to make sure that We are de-risking platforms, that we are focusing on making sure the life-altering mistakes that might happen that day don't happen.
Yes.
Because I think we all want to move more from the trauma cleanup business to the trauma prevention business. And that's going to require better innovation to make sure that the humans that are on the front lines of making these decisions, whether that be at the tech companies, nonprofits, law enforcement, the judicial system, or government folks, have the right information at the right time to take action before the consequences are something that we cannot go back on.
Does it also require a fundamental rethink in why some of these technologies are launched in the first place? You know, does there have to be a rethinking of the motivation, just that it can't just be about technology development for quick return on profit and investment and so on, that actually there has to be a genuine social impact and social good built into the fundamental structure of these technologies and their development, rather than a retrofitting for a veneer, if you like?
I think it depends on the topic you think through. Like, I mean, I think social media is great for adults. It doesn't work the same way maybe for developing adolescent minds. Yes. So I think that everything is nuanced, and we have to be more focused in the areas that we want to apply more regulation and more thoughtfulness in terms of design. I think everything evolves. I think it usually starts out as the Wild West, and then we get more aware of what can happen, and then we start to be a little bit more mindful about how we do things. Certainly in the data privacy space, that's how the field evolved. I expect to see the digital safety space evolve in a similar way, where legislation makes it financially impactful for companies to ignore. And so therefore they apply their best ideas in terms of how to innovate to meet the standard that is set for them. But it has to happen through legislation, I think, because everybody has to be held to a global standard, or else it's going to give very unfair advantages to companies that choose to not optimize for that.
Yeah. Lisa, we always end the podcast with asking our guests to offer one or two final pieces of wisdom for listeners to go away and think about and potentially activate in their business. When it comes to a more ethical approach to AI and technology, or around entrepreneurship, what would those two pieces of parting wisdom be from your perspective?
Good question. The first one that comes to mind for me is a quote from Oprah Winfrey that I lean on heavily because it inspires me, and that is, luck is the intersection of opportunity and preparedness. For myself, I spent a lot of time preparing, doing volunteer projects, slash jobs, nights and weekends, things for NGOs or for personal education, listening to podcasts, reading books, to make sure that if the opportunity presented itself, I was prepared to do something that was uniquely my own voice. So that's probably my first words of wisdom, is don't rule yourself out because you don't have the titles, the credentials, whatever else you want to say. Nobody here knows everything you need to know to be successful. It's always a team sport, and what you know is uniquely you, and other people don't know it. So make sure that when the opportunities come, you're prepared to take advantage of those. The second one that I had a sign by my sink when I brush my teeth every morning for 20 years, which is the well-behaved women rarely make history. I think it's been attributed to a lot of people, but it actually came from a Harvard professor in the 70s. And I think she used the word seldom instead of rarely. But long and short of it, I didn't grow up in a traditional gendered standard household. And so having that as lived experience, my dad did retire as a VP of environmental engineering from a company, but that happened much later in his career. He was the one that took me to all my sports practices and had a home cooked meal on the table every night while my mom got an MBA and broke into commercial banking. So I just really encourage people to remember that this is all a social construct, and there is a lot of room for different voices in the room, and we will get better outcomes for everyone when we allow that evolution to happen.
Lisa, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for your time.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Paul. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you'd like to learn more about what Lisa does, then please visit lisathee.com, LISATHEE.com, and you'll also find the links in the notes that accompany this podcast. And if you'd like to join the new P&L movement for more principled leadership and more purpose-led business, then please go to principlesandleadership.com and subscribe to our newsletter, where you'll receive our latest initiatives, news, and podcast episodes. If you have enjoyed today's episode, then please do take a moment to either rate us or review us. We genuinely appreciate it, and it all helps with our ratings and our rankings. So finally, I'm Paul, host of the new P&L. Thank you once again for listening this week, and have a great day.